Hello and welcome to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. I'm Ralph Russo, college football writer with the Associated Press. I know March Madness is starting this week and we're all pumped up to start diving into wall-to-wall basketball. But we'll stick to football on this show and we have two guests to do it this week. First up, we talk with Jared Parker, the new coach at Troy. We'll talk to him about making the move from Notre Dame to the Sun Belt and his evolution as an offensive coordinator. Next up, the great Bill Conley from ESPN joins us to talk about preseason SP Plus rankings and the trials and tribulations of expanding the college football playoff. Thanks for listening to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. You can find us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, just about anywhere you like to get your pods. If you like what you hear, and of course, why wouldn't you? Please give us a good rating and review. It helps college football fans find us. It helps us find more college football fans. And away we go. Joining me this week on the podcast is the new coach of Troy University, Jared Parker. Jared, former offensive coordinator for Notre Dame, decided to make the jump, his first job as a head coach. Jared, man, thank you so much, Coach Parker, for joining me today. How has the transition gone for you?
Well, first off, as I told you earlier, thanks so much for keeping in touch and having us on. It's an honor to be on. You know what? It's a question I've answered pretty often over the last 2.5-3 months, and I would say that it's like anytime you ask a coach how spring season has gone or how a transition's gone. I think everybody always says good, right?
Sure.
But I do mean it. It's been good because what is transition? It's learning new people. It's setting standards for what your program, what you want your program to look like. It's giving good direction and hiring a great staff and just throwing yourself in it. And for that, I would say that Troy's accepted us, me and my family and our football family and all the change and new. And then we've had the chance to really dive into this thing and go at it as best we could. And there's been a lot of moving parts. But the staff has really helped me. The players have really helped me. And certainly this community and Troy University has wrapped their arms around us. So all is well so far.
All right. So just to tie a bow on the personal side of things, Jared's got about 4 kids, sixth grade and under. Everybody's in Troy, everybody's in the new location. Wife found a house that went okay too. That part of it's been okay.
It's all been good. So okay. The stuff that doesn't get talked about enough, right? When you move 4 kids and your wife, and don't forget the dog.
Nice.
And you move down 12 hours south to a place that they'd never seen or been. And they just put their trust in their dad and their husband to make good decisions and do right by the family. It honestly is a pretty humbling thing when you start to really think about it and what the kids go through and going to their first day of school in a strange place. And it couldn't have gone better so far, and just humbled by what the kids go through for us to live out our dream.
So that ties into actually the first question I wanted to ask you about, and that is, you know, sort of why you make this move. You know, when you do what I do for a living, we cover coaching moves and sort of look at things as trends. But behind every trend is a personal decision, is a bunch of singular personal decisions. So when I ask you what about Troy lured you there, what I also wanted with the backdrop of, I got to say, like nowadays, a lot of coaches, a lot of assistants, and you're still a relatively young guy in your early 40s, I think have a mindset of, hey, once I'm at a Power Five and you were at Notre Dame, once I'm in that realm, I kind of need to stay here. Like, I think the dynamics have changed a little bit. Maybe 5-10 years ago, that's a no-brainer. I'm a coordinator at a Power Five. Maybe I got to take a little bit of a quote-unquote, I hate to even say this, but quote-unquote step down to get my first head coaching job. That seemed to be more the norm. Nowadays, I mean, you see guys giving up head coaching jobs in the Sun Belt to become assistants elsewhere. Again, there are personal decisions and personal aspects behind those. So when you're making that calculation, you have your personal side, and from the professional side, how did you weigh, man, like Notre Dame, that's a pretty good spot. Why is this the right opportunity for me to become a head coach for the first time?
Being at Notre Dame was special. It truly was and is. And the biggest things for me were I always wanted to become a head coach, and I didn't want to be a head coach just to say I was, or for a certain salary or whatever it may be. And then two was, it was definitely to become, to take over a program that expected and supported itself to win and to win championships. Cause I think that's when guys that you at least look at and say, all right, can this place win? Because if you take the wrong job and you can't win, it's just bad for everybody. It's bad for families. It's bad for staff, and it's bad for future. So I knew that Troy was a place that had won, a place that could win and supports itself to win. And then for me, why not bet on myself in a dream that I've had since I've gotten to college coaching, is to be a head coach and run our own program and do this way. To me, it's more important to learn how to be a head coach and get that experience now in that time, and also get around a bunch of people and help lead them and give them direction and change lives along the way. So I know that's a lengthy answer, but that's all the things that my wife and I went through in discussing about the pros and cons of doing it. And the pros outweighed the cons of staying for the reasons I just mentioned to you. And I'm just feel very happy about the decision we've made to be here and lead this program.
Hey, listen, it's a complicated question, so I expected a pretty lengthy answer, right? I mean, you have to weigh the professional and the personal. And again, Absolutely. There's a lot going on in college football these days. You know, you had never coached at Troy, but you had worked for Neil Brown, who was coach at Troy. I'm wondering, Neil or other people, you know, listen, the other thing too is these things happen so fast these days. Like, I don't know if you have a whole mess of chance to like do your research, so to speak. You know, again, you worked for Neil, so maybe that was a person you looked into, but who did you, as you're trying quickly nowadays to decide, am I going to take this job? Who did you tap into to determine that Troy's a place where you can win? Now, we have recent evidence that it's a place you can win, but you still want to get a little bit of a background of the place, a little bit of intel on the place.
Sure. I think that it allowed me, because of a couple of relationships that you just mentioned, it allowed me to get the information I needed to get quickly about this place, of the things I didn't already know. I knew some relationships with some people in my past of how well they spoke of this place and how well they loved living there, which really was something I paid attention to. But then quickly to be able to talk to Neil about the job, and I remembered working for him and how he spoke of this place, him and Brooke both, his wife. And then, of course, having a prior relationship with Coach Summerall and his wife and being here, I'd come to Troy before and stayed at his house when he worked here as an assistant. And so those two things were information I was able to gain quickly. And then, you know, besides my wife, I'd learned in the past, Ralph, like some mistakes I'd made. You can almost, in these big decisions, call and ask for too many mm-hmm. opinions. Mm-hmm. And I think it just, there's some other decisions I made where I just asked, I was trying to be so thorough, it probably paralyzed me, which is sometimes what we're guilty of in coaching our players. And I relied on, honestly, I called Randy Sanders. Randy has been a guy that has been the biggest mentor to me in this profession. I called him. He's retired. He's fishing. And I knew, and he always tells me straight up, he doesn't mess with it, and gave me some great advice. And I called and bounced it off him. And after we talked and got to a place where I knew this is something I wanted to do, I just kind of ripped the Band-Aid and said, let's do this if they're able to offer me the job. And we went with it.
So you were offensive coordinator at Notre Dame last year. You had done a stint as offensive coordinator with West Virginia with Neil Brown. I'm wondering, because that's often a position that leads to being a head coach, what was the difference between offensive coordinator in those two situations? And I guess, how were you a different offensive coordinator? excuse me. How were you a different offensive coordinator at Notre Dame than maybe you were with Neil when he first handed the job off to you? And, you know, I know play calling can always be kind of a sticky thing with coaches. Who's calling the plays? What's the process there? But how did that transition, again, from being offensive coordinator for Neil and then getting a taste of it under Marcus? How did you become a different offensive coordinator?
Yeah, again, you're good at this. This is a great question. Like, so when Neil and I got together and we took the job from Penn State to West Virginia, he did a phenomenal job of laying out expectations of what I would do initially coming in. So I knew that I was not going to be the primary play caller in the beginning of it. And he gave me far more than what probably I thought maybe early on going into year one. And that was COVID year, right? That was a tough year. Mm-hmm. And then in year two, we went through a tough transition of a tough start, and we went through, and now I became a primary play caller at times, and that of second year at the end. Neil was so detailed, and he's an offensive guy, right? He's been an offensive coordinator for a long time. He's called a ton of plays, many more than me, and he's an offensive head coach for it. That got me ready in so many ways to coordinate with him, but also, more importantly, it got me ready to coordinate at Notre Dame. And that was the biggest growth for me. Like so many things, sometimes I think coaches who want to be head coaches, and now I can say this, say, well, do you need to be a coordinator to then become a head coach? Well, it's not the coordinating title or that you're doing it. In my mind now, sitting back, it's managing people, staff and players, and having a plan together before everybody else comes in from a weekend and all the things that you have to have ready to prepare to be a coordinator and coordinate a group of people and players. So that's what West Virginia afforded me. So when I sat in the chair at Notre Dame, or it was time for me to interview and get that job, when it went through the layers of that job being open, I felt prepared. I did not feel unprepared, nervous, or wonder. I knew I could do the job. I knew it was a big job to do. And one of the biggest pieces of it was empowering the staff that was around me. And that's what Notre Dame, and contrary to maybe some of the beliefs of depending on what fan bases may think, you know, the success we had on offense and the things we were able to do in year one is something that I would certainly put out in front and be very proud of as my career moves forward. But that West Virginia job and the job that Neil did for me got me ready for that chair, if that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. And then you kind of opened the door there to something I wanted to ask you about anyway, and that is this idea. Listen, Notre Dame, that's a tough place, man. Like you were under a ton of scrutiny, but it's a great place because you were under a lot of scrutiny and you get you get the privilege of that scrutiny, right? You get the privilege of those high expectations at Notre Dame. Notre Dame's offense last year on paper, you know, and not just on paper, on the field, produced one of the most successful offenses they've had at that school in years, statistically. But, you know, again, it's Notre Dame. So if you have a little bit of a tough game against one of the best defenses in the country against Ohio State, you hear about it. I guess just from the standpoint of sitting in that type of pressure, and again, pressure is a privilege. I get all that. But, you know, again, sort of a what did you learn question, especially with Marcus, because Marcus is a defensive guy. And I'm sure he gave you his thoughts and some ideas about what he wants philosophically. But when he's a defensive guy, it's not like with Neil. He's putting you in that chair to run that offense and to call them plays. So I guess what I would ask you is the learning process of just being in a place where there is that much pressure and that much scrutiny.
Yeah, I think, again, fair question and a great question. When you have a passionate fan base and one of the best fan bases in the country, that's the price of admission. And I think for me to see Marcus and to see our program, that program in year one, and see him handle it when you lose your first two games, one being to Ohio State and the other to Marshall, and see how he handled it, and just getting lost in the work and the non-flinch and just fixing things with urgency, all the things he did, it models that, and some other past things that you go through in coaching model it. So I think as much as you can be, I was prepared for that. I don't know if my family was prepared for that, which is a whole other thing, for them to go through it, Ralph. But I think for me, I understood it and knew it. It still hurts you. You still, for the most part, hurt more for your players than anything because you know what's put in. And if you finish a game against Ohio State or all the other things that you wish and could haves and should haves, we know that you're this far away from the narrative being so different. But that's the life we live. And I'm willing to accept that and certainly want to put it in front of your players to make sure they know you're going to stand for them. And that part, what was the toughest part, was managing for your family. But for the most part, I knew expectations. I knew how it was going to be handled. And would like to say that you got to have broad shoulders and stand in front of your group and own those. And we did that.
Hey, you know, another interesting thing about your progression to offensive coordinator is it didn't run through the quarterback position, so to speak, because that's pretty common these days. The quarterback coach is the offensive coordinator. You've been a wide receivers coach, tight ends coach for a little while. I'm not saying it can't be done. There are plenty of guys who have done that, who have become offensive coordinators or, you know, not having gone through coaching quarterbacks, but it is a little different nowadays. What was the learning process like there as far as just like being now as the offensive coordinator? You have to be a lot more involved in coaching quarterback in some way, shape, or form. It might not be your position, but you better have a good relationship and understand how the quarterback, how coaching a quarterback works. So what was that like for you to get sort of embedded with the quarterback, but not necessarily be the quarterback coach?
Yeah, I think it is something to work through. I think here's why. Now, I was blessed when I GA'd in 07 to be around Joker Phillips, who was the offensive coordinator and coach wideouts, and a guy named Randy Sanders, who I just alluded to speaking to, a lifelong mentor now. And he was the quarterback's coach with major college experience from his Tennessee days with Coach Cutcliffe, so on and so forth. That model really helped me because I remember what that looked and felt like and thought that relationship was phenomenal. So I remembered that. Then for me and for us to make that good, you have to have a special person coaching quarterbacks. One that you trust, two that's knowledgeable and could do it just as well or better than me or anyone else. And that, in my mind, is Gino Gadulli. So Gino being there, having coordinator experience, having a guy that you could trust with your life that I would fight for to this day and moving forward really gave me peace of mind knowing, hey, Gino's a pro. Let Gino be a pro. Let him coach the quarterback. Ask the right questions. Make sure those quarterbacks know me and know how we're thinking. Go over the plan at the end of the week and meet with Sam and make sure I know what he likes and what he wants, especially situationally, and empower him and the guys. That's how I chose to do it. And it worked well for us, you know, and it did mostly because, again, the coaching ability of Gino, along with Sam and the other guys, Angeli and Mitch and those guys, just being able to take it in, gain information from Gino, get anything they need from me, not let me step on toes and get in the way just to be heard, but also no expectations and lead that way. And it worked for us. But that's how it has to work. Because any other way, it won't work.
Okay, I got to ask you one quick thing about Gino. Gino Gadulli is the quarterback's coach at Notre Dame, and he was at Cincinnati, and he does a really good job. So I got to know Gino a little bit. So how fun was it to coach Sam Hartman? He seems like a cool player to work with because of obviously the experience there, and he seems like he has a pretty good mind for the game. That flowing hair is always, I'm sure, makes you jealous, you know, looking like that. Man, we should all be so lucky, man, look like that kid. But what was it like coaching Sam?
Well, it was great. And listen, to be fair, you think about the growth and the pattern in which he had to go through from start to finish, deciding to go and do another year of college football first, then choosing Notre Dame, all to then lose the coordinator, get a new coordinator, have to put all the information through, get a new quarterback's coach along with the coordinator, and get through all that. And then, oh, by the way, learn how to come out of the huddle, go under center, learn verbiage and more of a West Coast NFL-style offense, all the things that were something that gives him even a better chance to becoming a pro, which, you know, he's going through the process of now. So, to be fair to him, that was a lot, you know, and to do the things he did and the growth he had in that, I think everybody will see how much that did help him. And I know Sam feels that way too. He changed the way we prepared, especially in our pass game, by getting around the other quarterbacks and showing them the way it's going to take to get timing down with our wideouts and our skill players, get throwing times together in the summer and hold guys accountable and make sure they're there. Those are the things he brought to the table, which gave him instant credibility in our locker room and with our coaching staff. And he and I took a lot of the scrutiny that you already alluded to, which is the way it works with quarterbacks and coordinators, especially on the offensive side of the ball. And he stood in that fire with me and like I did as well and owned it. And those are the things that make him a pro, and certainly got through an experience of having Notre Dame that he'll always have no matter what. He can go back and walk down that tunnel and be a part of something he did on offense and being a part of that locker room.
Okay, we're going to head down the home stretch here, and let's talk about what you found at Troy in terms of not just the facilities and the things like that and the commitment to win, and they've done really, really well the last couple of years. John Summerall did an amazing job. I mean, what, like 20, 22 wins the last couple of years, 23? I might be cutting them short a little bit there. But that almost doesn't even matter in the portal age, right? Nowadays, like, oh, well, I think I'm going to have a pretty good roster because we recruited it pretty well beforehand. You step in there and What did you have? What were you able to keep? What were you able to add? Again, that alone has just got to be like, you know, such a challenging part of what you're stepping into with a new job, because, you know, in the old days you used to be able to sort of look at the roster and think like, okay, I think I can work with this. And now from the time you hit the ground, you're just hoping to keep, you know, keep kids in the boat. So what was that part of the transition like for you?
Yeah, that part's not easy. And hadn't been easy. So past success certainly helps you make decisions about future success and coming here. But at the same time, you understand that, like, here's the realities, right? Your roster is under attack every year, spring and fall semester, at the end of fall, and now at the end of spring, it will be again. We've had to flip the roster. A lot of people say they have to, but we're talking, Ralph, probably close to 45 new scholarship players by the time we line up next fall, 45 out of 85. I think there's about 76% of our defense gone, 60-some% of our offense gone, 27 new staff members. All to say, I know society doesn't care, and you'll hear me say it all the time, and we'll laugh, but that's real. I mean, like, this is the most change that Troy's been through, both as roster change and by staff change through all the other coaches, because there's been a lot of guys that were kept and stayed on, and we've only had two guys that stayed here with us. Through that time. So we have a bunch of change here. And how do you embrace change, and how do you get this wired all right? You got to have a good plan, got to have great direction, and you got to have great players.
I noticed just from looking at the numbers, like, you know, Bill Conley's SP Plus does the returning production. And you mentioned, you know, some of what you said with their numbers, and Troy was way down. Now, what kind of work were you able to do in the portal? And, you know, again, you're building on relationships. You're probably, especially for a new coach, you have to also balance, I need a linebacker. I'm just throwing the positions out here. I need X amount of linebackers. I need a couple of, you know, a couple of offensive linemen. I need a wide receiver. You need talent, but you're also new. You need to try to create your culture. That's an even more pivotal part of your first season. So, man, the portal work must have been important, but also even more tricky, because you can't just get the best player. Maybe you want to get the best player available, but you also have to worry what that player is going to look like as you're trying to create a culture.
Yeah, it's the toughest thing we're all having to do in college football. You're having to make such, you know, it's, we laugh, we've said it's speed dating, right?
Yeah.
When you get into that end of the year, end of the season, you're making decisions. You're having to make big decisions about the people you bring into your program, and you got to make them fast. So the connections we have to Power Five, Group of Five programs and all over through our staff has really helped us, I hope. We've acquired the best we could to get the right people in, and if they didn't fit, they didn't fit. And then we'll still acquire some in May, June, just like everybody else is looking to try to get the right people to keep filling in gaps. But you have to make the decisions on what you're saying, guys that will help us win games, but also going to be able to fit Troy. You know, it's, and what does that mean? That means the place, but also our people in this building. And I'm trying to make those decisions. Our staff's trying to make those decisions the best we can. We'll not be perfect. And we understand that. But I think if we have that in mind to continue to make decisions on what's best for Troy and who fits Troy, we'll get closer to right, and then we will we'll see where we're at in the fall.
All right, last one for you is so spring ball starts tomorrow. Did I get that right when we were chatting before we got on the air here?
That's right.
All right, what you're most looking forward to?
Well, so this is a great question, because I think everybody needs to get out on the grass and go to practice.
Yeah.
You know, we. Ultimately, in the end, one of the funnest parts of our job is to be on the field coaching, doing what we love to do as player coach. And I'm really excited for our program to finally get to the grass and do that. For me, the biggest thing I want to see our guys do is truly learn how to practice. It's a behavior that sounds so simple, but everybody forgets it. And what does that look like? How we transition from drill to drill, the habits that we practice with in our effort, and how well we take care of the ball. And how well we take the ball away, that's going to be critical for us and our success. We know that. Turnover margin's it. And I think, if anything, I want to hope that and pray that we learn how to practice, meaning our health too, that we take care of our football team. We learn the tempo of each drill. We keep each other off the ground as much as we possibly can, and we keep our health. So if we can learn how to practice with each other and keep each other healthy, and we can manage the details of what it means to take care of the football and take it away, that's really the two things that I hope we really capitalize on, especially these first six practices.
Jared Parker is the new coach at Troy. It's a championship-level program. Starting from scratch, because you have a lot of built-in advantages there. You got the bones of a champion. Good luck with it, Jared. Good luck with spring practice, and hopefully we can run into each other down the road.
Please stay in touch, and thanks again for having us on.
Joining me this week, Bill Conley from ESPN, the great Bill Conley, the mastermind behind SP Plus. Bill, thank you very much for doing this. You've already graced us with your early preseason SP Plus rankings. Always great. As far as I'm concerned, that sort of kicks off the preview season for the next season. Now, that's ridiculous, because that means we're previewing next season for like 6 months. But this is what college football is. It's basically 6 months of us convincing ourselves we know, or 5 months of us convincing ourselves we know what's going to happen.
Well, and that's been my lane for a long time, right? Yes. It's like the conference previews or the team previews that start pretty much immediately after those first SP Plus rankings. I took the hint from college football last year and realized there's absolutely no point in writing big previews until after the next transfer window.
Right.
Because I still have nightmares about that AAC preview that I wrote that was outdated, dramatically outdated within 3 days last year. So, yeah, that'll all come later on. But it certainly helps me. Spit out those initial projections. Then I go through kind of the slow roster updating process. But just kind of knowing how things start out, I think, is a really good thing, even though we know things are about to change here in another couple months.
Yeah, and change. That is the theme of the 2024 college football season. Between realignment and the playoff, we are venturing into a new world in which success will be measured very differently. And I think that a glimpse into that new world and how power it will be distributed and across the map was given not just at the end of last year's rankings, but at your preseason rankings, because you look at it and I believe there is only one non-SC or two, if you want to count, let's count Notre Dame, among the top 15 teams in the country. Only two of them are not in either the SEC or the Big Ten. So, we all knew that where this was going, Bill, but it does feel a lot more stark when you start looking at it. And I'm sure that's what you felt when you saw your numbers generate what they did.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about that. I was trying to prevent myself from thinking about this last year, too, because we had, so many conference races that mattered heading into the home stretch last year. Could Texas get to the finish line with just the one blemish? Could Florida State get there unblemished, which, we thought mattered anyway? The Pac-12 race was super interesting and mattered. There were just so many different avenues here that were really interesting. And then I sort of realized at one point, just about everybody who's involved in these conference title races is going to be in the Big Ten or SEC next year. And that sucks. And because, you look at the rankings right now, it is 13 out of 15 are either Big Ten or SEC. What is it? Four Big Tens and, eight SECs. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of stinks because Ole Miss is projected eighth. They're probably not going to be in the title race. It's probably, Georgia, then Texas, then everybody else. They could fight their way into the race, but a lot of these really, really good teams aren't going to be involved in title races. And that was one of the, when we expanded, that was one of the more fun things to me, was to think about all the games that will now matter in late November that didn't matter before for playoff purposes. There's going to still be a lot that matters. Big 12 is still going to have eight teams that are exactly the same. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be an absolute battle royal, but only one of those teams is getting in. We know that kind of in advance almost. And it just kind of seems to limit, when you have that many teams from two conferences, it kind of just seems to, I don't know. I'm in my morose offseason mood right now. I'll still get excited when Ohio State plays Oregon and whatnot next year, but it is kind of it's not as fun to think about all these different title races when only two of them have most of the top teams.
Yeah, I've been writing and saying a lot, we are not getting the playoff we were promised. Right.
Right.
When this all started in 2021 and we had a Power Five, and before all the realignment nonsense, and then the tipping of the scales for the SEC and the Big Ten to a certain degree, first monetarily and then trying to do so through automatic qualifying bids, though that's been put off for that conversation has been put off for 2026. It has been a bit of a deflating off season. But they do get you with the schedule, right? Isn't that the way they get you, right? Because you're going to see Ohio State, Oregon on the schedule and go, oh, but I really want to see that. I will compromise my standards and my morals because I would really like to see that game to a certain degree. So that's how they get you. But as we sort of look through the lens of again, what is successful, I wonder how much you've thought and translated your numbers with, because, you know, the SP Plus, you then convert them into ranking, into predictions for win totals. And are you noticing that, this is a good team, but if when you start translating what their schedule looks like in the SEC and the Big Ten, especially with those strength of schedule being bumped up, that was a team that I would have maybe expected to win 10 games, and now I'm projecting them to maybe get to 9, because that's really going to be, again, one of the focal points of this new world order, of this idea that undefeated probably not happening that much anymore, and 2-3 losses could still be a championship level team.
Yeah, it was funny. They really gave OU the be careful what you wish for schedule. I know a lot of OU fans are all just complaining. Like our home schedules just aren't all that impressive. You know, we never get Texas at home. I'm tired of Kansas State and, you know, having to worry about beating them and blah, blah, blah. Well, here you go. You get the schedule that you said you wanted, and you have what is, according to SP Plus, the 14th best team in the country, and you're projected to win 7.6 games on average. USC is projected 23rd with 6.1 wins on average. So, yeah, congratulations. what my joke with my editor for a long time has been, Big Ten and SEC are going to have all the money. They're going to be rich and completely miserable, while Big 12 has all the fun. And that's, you know, I hope that's kind of the way things work. But, no, it's one of the things when looking at the, I don't think I shared the projected win totals in the February rankings. Maybe I did, but I don't think so. One of the things that I was really curious about was, those win totals. Is that still going to be pretty well distributed among the big conferences, even if the quote unquote quality isn't? Not as much as I thought. We're looking at basically Notre Dame starting off with 10.4 wins on average. That's actually the highest, along with Oregon at 10.4, Ohio State at 10.3, Georgia at 10.3, Penn State at 10.2. They have a nice schedule for themselves. Mm-hmm. And then Texas at 10.0. Those are the 10-win teams, so to speak, in terms of average totals. No ACC team there. The highest ACC team is Florida State at 9.3. They still have a lot of loss opportunities. Mm-hmm. Big 12 has Utah at like 9.5. But, yeah, it's kind of – I guess maybe in part because the SEC still has only 8-game conference schedules. That's going to allow some teams to stock up, so to speak, and go 5-3 in conference and have 9-3 overall and still have something of a playoff case. And I don't know. We'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, that's we'll get into the selection process in a second, because I think the discussion about automatic qualifiers that drove everybody insane and money distribution, and again, sort of the tipping of the scales for the SEC and the Big Ten to themselves when they already have all these advantages, I think will eventually shift to a discussion of how the playoff teams are picked. We will get there, but I also wanted to bring this up. Last year, we had a little more parity than we're used to. And it ended up being, as you said, a very fun year, because that parity or those big teams, those playoff contenders were distributed nicely across the country. A lot of races were interesting. And we ended up with an unusual playoff of Washington and Michigan playing for the national championship. And no Georgia, even though they were coming off two straight national championships. It felt like, in many ways, the ideal four-team playoff. In the final year of the four-team playoff, we finally got the one that we were waiting for. And I wonder this year, Now, again, we have the 12-team dynamic and the increased difficulty of the schedules. But I also look at Georgia sitting atop of your SP Plus rankings at 34.5, 4 points better than Ohio State. That seems like a pretty big gap, and Ohio State's pretty good at 30. And I'm wondering if maybe even though we have a 12-teamer, we might be reverting a little bit back to super team mode in college football.
Well, I think it's just basically the timing's really good for Georgia right now in the fact that, you know, so many teams lose their quarterbacks and Georgia returns theirs. Their defense, I think, returns a little more experience than they're used to it returning. So I think overall, these last few years, what we've seen in this transfer portal era, the NIL, you know, kind of the quote-unquote super teams not necessarily being the best at NIL compared to other teams that are finding this as an opportunity to really try to go all in, at least for a year or two. I feel like talent has been more properly distributed these last couple of years. You know, just when you look at where some of the top recruits have gone, where you see how many, like, even I'm slowly updating rosters here for 2024. It shocked me the other day, like UMass now has like 10 former blue chippers and a whole bunch of like mid to high three-star guys. And that doesn't really, they don't really stand out in that regard because the freedom of player movement has meant that, you know, so to speak, water finds its level a little better, and the talent, you have more access to different streams of talent, I guess you could say. Yeah. So if you're good at roster building, you have an opportunity to have a more talented roster than you normally do right now. And that's really cool. I encourage any and all parity efforts. It is possible that Georgia just screws everything up by being too good this year. But I think in general, what we've seen so far, it has been encouraging when it comes to parity. It's harder to stockpile talent than it used to be, even if Georgia's doing a pretty good job of it right now.
Yeah. I wondered if you, because, you know, and I always like to say this when you're on, Bill, even Bill doesn't think his numbers are the last word. I think they, you know, and we love your numbers, and they are a great guide and often provide a lot of good insight. So when you looked at what your numbers churned out among the top, you know, 15 to 20 teams, I had this conversation with Andy Staples. Since every conversation that we have with our college football covering friends is a podcast, I had this conversation with Andy on his podcast. He was asking me, hey, you know, who do you think might be a little bit of a disappointment last year? So I opened up SP Plus and I found myself going on my general principle of find the team that overachieved a little bit last year and right, be bearish on them this year. So your beloved Missouri Tigers were the team that I picked of, like, I know they're expected to do very well. They have a lot coming back, but I'm going to shade Missouri a little bit. Was there anybody that you looked at, even though the numbers say it should be in line for a pretty nice year, that you thought, you know, if I'm going to put a little star of skepticism next to that, there's a place I'm going to go.
Yeah, well, I mean, Missouri is a really interesting team in that regard, and that, like, you know, they're projected 11th right now. That's earned. I mean, they were that good last year. It wasn't just like they won 10 close games and they had a great record, but they were only like 38th in SP Plus or something. That doesn't happen. That's like the Northwestern special right there.
Yeah.
But but Missouri, like, graded out genuinely well. It is still a concern, though, that they were 4-0 and one score finishes last year. You don't do that 2 years in a row. And granted, they've been unlucky. They've been all over the map in that regard, come to think of it, during the Drinkwitz era. They were very good in close games in 2020, which meant they finished 5-5, even though they weren't really very good. The next couple of years, they got better, but they lost their close games and went 6-7 both years. Then they won them all again last year. So they've been kind of careening back and forth. They're probably due to drop a couple close games that they didn't drop last year, and that alone might knock them out of the playoff race. Same time, three of those close wins came before they were good last year. It took them a few weeks to be good. They survived early against Middle Tennessee and Memphis and K-State, and then they kind of hit the accelerator, and they were actually winning games by bigger margins for the most part down the stretch. So maybe that's a good sign that they can overcome that. But just the simple fact that they went 4-0 in one score games is a massive red flag typically, and it's going to be pretty hard. Overall, like, I think the there weren't that many rankings that surprised me all that much. I mean, LSU being 10th surprised me a little bit. Mm-hmm. Just because, like, they were so uniquely special on offense last year. All the numbers see that they lose Jaden Daniels and therefore they drop from first to third in offense. I would be surprised if they're top five in offense, top 10 maybe this year. So maybe it's hard for them to live up to a number 10 ranking overall. But I do think the main takeaway I get from this is that, I mean, a lot of these, you know, the teams, while Georgia's way out ahead of the pack, teams 2 through 10 are separated by basically a touchdown.
Which is pretty good.
What are we looking at here? Like number 12 through 20 are separated by a touchdown. Like within these groups, somebody's going to go 4-0 in one score game. Somebody's going to go 0-4 in one score games. And so the records are going to not be very evenly distributed, even if the numbers are pretty even right now.
So I want to let you vent here for a second, Bill, because you wrote about, and I've vented a bunch over the last, and I even referenced it when I said we're not getting the playoff. We were promised, and it's been pretty frustrating to watch the SEC and the Big Ten really flex their muscle on the financial side, getting much higher distributions than the other two conferences, because we do, as much as you can overcome that, it's not all about money. But it sure helps to have the most money. And now they have these stack conferences. And again, they decided to flex their muscle. And then they tried to flex their muscle a little bit in terms of automatic qualifying bids. And that's been tabled. We're not really going to talk about that for a little
now.
While.
They made a point of saying for now.
Yeah, without question, for now, that's been tabled. And it's just, I find it, you know, and eventually I'm going to get a chance to ask Greg Sankey and Tony Petitti this simple question is, how is this good for college football as a whole?
Yeah.
Like you guys are supposed to be not just guardians of your own fiefdoms and your own domain, though I understand that's always tricky. That's one of the tricky parts about the sport, right? In that you have multiple the people who are the leaders are leading multiple different in multiple different areas. And you have your sort of, and you have to, you're being asked to think beyond your own backyard. But it seems like at this point, we're all just at the, you know, at the mercy of the benevolence of the SEC and the Big Ten. So again, I'm just going to let you, I teed you up on that. Go for it, man.
Here, let me crack my knuckles.
Okay.
Let me clear my throat. No. It just kind of started adding up on me last week. Not that it started last week, but like it hit me over the weekend. I joked on Twitter about this. Like, what was it, 2021 when the first 12-team playoff came out or proposal came
yep.
out? And
summer of 20.
Greg Sankey was
June.
Kind of like the biggest voice for that.
Yep.
And then he goes and takes Texas and Oklahoma. And everybody starts acting like the 12-team proposal has some like invisible ink where as soon as everybody signs it, it's going to say like SEC teams get every spot in the field or something. They started treating it as some sort of suspicious proposal when it was about the most benevolent thing you'll ever see Greg Sankey do. Like it was four conference champions automatically get the bye. So he's only one SEC team can get a bye in the field. That was pretty great. Like there were a lot of things to really like from a, whatever the, you know, I don't know the best word for it, but just like it was guaranteeing access in a way that I was kind of worried
access.
It wouldn't.
Access
way.
Is the was the yeah. thing that it was sold on, and it looked like if you looked at the proposal and the old conference alignment, you saw this looks yeah. like a pretty good opportunity
yeah.
for access and that access lifting up those conferences.
And granted, you know, 12 was a weird number. And like, I've gone back and looked at like 60 years of playoff arguments and like nobody ever brought up 12 ever. So that was a little strange to me. And I was just thinking like, why wouldn't you just go to 16? Like has been talked about many times over the last few decades, but whatever, like it made a lot of sense. And it was like when the quote unquote alliance, which was just the, of all the things I've been wrong about, I was right about the alliance from the start, at least, and how pointless and ridiculous that was. But they, you know, the Big Ten and ACC and Pac-12 band together and resist this evil 12-team playoff that would only help them. And it's like Greg Sankey at that moment said, well, fine, if you're not going to take my benevolent offer, I'm just going to become the biggest villain the college sports has ever seen. And everything he's done since then has been in favor of the SEC and only SEC, even though he's friends with the Big Ten now, even though the Pac-12 is not a thing anymore. It really the shift happened. It seemed like it happened right around that moment. I think I might be making this up. I might be hallucinating at this point, but I seem to remember like a Sankey quote of basically saying, "Well, I guess I have to reassess my approach now," or something. When everything got turned down initially, but
yeah, I was there for that one. That was at a college football playoff, and I think there's some truth to that. Yes.
Yeah. So I kind of like when I hallucinate things. It makes it a lot more fun. But these last couple of weeks, what we've seen from, you know, them kind of floating out that proposal of it, well, a 14 team playoff has two byes. Why don't we just go ahead and give the SEC and the Big Ten those byes? That got predictably mocked and massacred online. But the Big Ten and SEC are already making more television revenue, media rights revenue than anybody else. That's set in stone. If you have the same kind of guaranteed appearance, not fee, but reward that exists in the old CFP, where if you make the playoff, you get X million dollars. If you have that in place, the SEC and the Big Ten are going to benefit from that because they're going to have the best conferences and have the most teams in the field. So that's fine. But now they're also wanting, or they're getting, more just annual guaranteed money beyond these other thing advantages that they already had. And no matter what, like a really good Memphis team is going to make like $1.8 million in guaranteed money from the playoff, while Vanderbilt makes $21 million every single year, year after year after year. They're just going to get $20 million more for existing in the right conference within the college football playoff structure. That's just ridiculous. Like, this is, you have the advantages. You don't need to bake in more advantages because it is at some point starving the ecosystem, for lack of a better phrase. Like, we are in a position now where we know in one way or another, athletes are going to be getting paid soon, whether it's as employees or whether it's grants or whatever ends up, you know, if the NCAA gets to decide or whether the courts foist it upon them. Athletes are going to be making a lot more money through the athletic departments than they currently are. And so, you know, you could use this. What I wrote over the weekend was like, you could use this expanded playoff and the like $900 million it could make, especially if it was 16 teams. You could use this as a way to basically pay for the future of college athletics. Everybody, like the $30,000 per athlete thing that Charlie Baker proposed in December, like you could pay for most Division I athletes to make $30,000 with this brand new money cannon. And that would be to me a pretty justifiable reason to expand the NCAA tournament too. It's been a long time since it expanded. And so, yeah, sure. Like 80 or whatever the number needs to be. Add some
tournament.
More television
right.
revenue for right. the NCAA tournament, because you have to pay for all these new things that are coming down the pike. And instead we're just going to give it all to the SEC and the Big Ten. And I tried to get out my thoughts as clear as possible in that Friday piece, but it really was like, that's of all the bitter tastes you can get from these power plays, that was the most bitter. You already have all the advantages, and now you're going to prevent teams from maybe being able to survive in a big time football universe because you want more money, because somehow eventually we're going to create a situation where if we just give Illinois more and more money, they're going to be better than Florida State or something. You know, it's not, I don't know. Like it's really, really frustrating. And it's frustrating that, you know, for 70 years now, the NCAA has refused to compromise, refused to settle, refused to do anything because it wanted to protect this ideal of amateurism, when really the ideal of any number of different types of schools getting shots at national titles, that kind of benevolent aspect of that should be the main ideal of the NCAA. No matter where you go to school, you have a shot at the title. That feels a lot better than we got to figure out a way to make sure our athletes aren't paid and we're never going to settle in court. I hopefully this fulfilled the rant that you were hoping for, but it's just gross. It's really, really gross. And I don't know if there's a way to stop it. The only thing that college sports fans seem to be willing to protest about is tournament expansion in college basketball, which seems really, really weird and misguided to me compared to everything else that's going on.
Yeah.
But that's the one thing we seem to be willing to fight against.
So among the many things that I worry about is this idea that if you continually marginalize, and that's a word I've been getting a lot of use out of, if you continually marginalize your competition, how much before the fans of those teams say, I'm out.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I don't care about your playoff because we really can't. And as much as the Big Ten has a lot of fans and the SEC has a lot of fans, and I think I've heard Greg Sankey and people in the SEC too. Listen, I don't want to make Sankey out to be the ultimate villain here, because I do think a lot of some of the AQ conversation was driven by the Big Ten, and we'll get into that in a second. I think more of that.
They're definitely a team now.
Yeah, I think more of that was driven by the Big Ten, frankly. The money conversation might have been just as much SEC Big Ten, but I think the Big Ten is worried a little bit more about the AQ conversation because they don't get treated the same way as the SEC. But when you start starving your competition and marginalizing your competition, at a certain point, I do wonder, as big as those fan bases are in the SEC and the Big Ten, and as much as the SEC likes to say, we have a national brand. We know, like, people watch our games all over. And that is true. This ain't the NFL. The popularity of college football is nowhere near close to the same as the NFL, where you can put a Jags Panthers game on a Thursday night and somehow 15 million people will go to a streaming service and watch it. This ain't that. No. So I do wonder, for all the talk of, you know, and again, coming from Sankey, hey, we need to have strong West Coast football. We need to have we're trying to make this a national sport. And you can say, well, we're going to get strong West Coast football, but it's going to be in the Big Ten. Like, at a certain point, if you're only propping up 30 or about 30 odd teams, when does that hurt the sport nationally? Because all those fans of all those other teams that had some tether to the big prize just say, yeah, no, we don't have that anymore. I'm done.
Yeah. All of these big brands that are now, for the most part, in two conferences became big brands because they won a lot of games. And so you think about, you know, you're adding Oklahoma to the SEC. Well, you know, Oklahoma versus Florida, that's brand versus brand. That's awesome. Are people going to watch if it's 5-5 Oklahoma versus 4-6 Florida? Or would they rather watch 8-1 Oklahoma versus 7-2 Oklahoma State or Kansas State or whatever? Like, part of the reason they became brands was success. And now you're in a situation. It reminds me of back when the soccer Super League thing happened in 2021. You know, you compiled all the brands that have ever won anything and made all the money in soccer. Well, somebody's going to finish in last place. Like, somebody's going, if we eventually get this, we always talk about the Super League thing, college football, like 30, 40 teams or whatever. Like, somebody's going 0-12 in that league. Mm-hmm. And how does that benefit them? And how does it benefit college football if you've basically declared, here are all the brands we ever want, and half of them are going to lose a ton of games? Like, none of this makes any sense from a long-term future standpoint. And, you know, I referenced in the piece in the column from Friday, like, we do have this history of basically saying that this whatever this thing is I don't like is going to kill college football.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
head injuries are going to kill college football. Targeting penalties that are attempting to address head injuries are going to kill college football.
Yeah. NIL,
big playoffs, small playoffs, all this stuff is going to kill college football. Nothing does. And last year, granted, you know, gambling probably helped with some of this, but ratings were great last year. And even after all the bitterness of the realignment from August, ratings were fantastic. Attendance was good. All the health indicators in that regard are really good. But are they going to remain good if, yeah, you're telling Kansas State you don't matter anymore? Stop coming to games because you're not playing for anything. I don't know. Like, that's the biggest concern to me, seems to be going out of your way to kill enthusiasm for, at the minimum, like 20, 30, 40 school programs in college football. And that seems to be what we're trying to do right now. And that's just, it's horrific. And I'm not going to declare it's going to kill college football. I've only been wrong when I've said that, but that feels very damaging to me.
Okay, I'm going to have a 5-minute conversation here with you about, because I believe the focus of this next, the next interesting debate in the playoff will be not necessarily about money or even maybe AQs. It's going to be about the selection committee. I don't think I'm going to put this very simply. I don't think the Big Ten trusts the selection committee, and the selection committee has a very different job with four teams. Most likely, even if you're not that good, you're probably going to get it right because the teams just sort of, the best teams really do stand out. I don't think we will have as big a debate over 12 being left out, 12 and 13, because again, at that point you can also say, "Huh, you had your chance, tough."
Right.
However, just the structure of how the teams are picked, I do think I think the selection committee and the people on it are really trying to do a good job, but I do wonder if they need more tools and guidance and a little more to help focus what exactly they're trying to choose in the new world order. The floor is yours, math boy. Like, tell me what needs to be done.
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, the Big Ten should be a little concerned here because they now have, you know, using SP Plus for this coming season, they have four teams in the top seven. They also have four teams in the top 22. Like, this is still a this has always been a pretty top heavy conference with a lot more dead weight than the SEC tends to have. And that's absolutely going to be the case this season, too. Then, in terms of average projected SP Plus, they're closer to the Big 12 than the SEC. So, yeah, in that sense, you're not getting a massive schedule, especially if Washington falls off this year, since they have to replace virtually everybody. It's quite possibly pull a TCU in that regard. USC still might not have a defense. I'm quietly optimistic that they're going to improve on that side of the ball, but I don't have any evidence for that. UCLA seems to be rebuilding now. So you really could be in a four-team conference and not really benefit from being a super conference in that regard. So yes, in that sense, they should be concerned, but stop trying to rig the field all the same. I have a piece going up this week where I kind of talk about, like, we saw, I know not everybody, I thought the Alabama over Florida State thing last year was absolutely unforgivable in every possible way. I realize not everybody thinks that, and different points of view, that's fine. Maybe you don't think that was completely unforgivable, but it's among everything, anything else we've learned over these last 10 years is that no matter how many big esteemed names you try to put on a college football playoff committee, it's not going to be any better than a BCS formula. Like, all the problems we had with the BCS was like who finished third. So if they were picking four teams, it wouldn't have been nearly as much of a problem. And we would have had weird results and we would have complained, but I don't think if like the BCS had been a playoff that started in 1998, we would still have a formula now. Mm-hmm. So we could always go back to a formula approach, even if it's like, you know, instead of 50-50 polls and computers or whatever, the polls are, you know, a college football committee, voting on a top 25 that makes half the rankings. Having an objective piece back in there is, there was a reason they put it in there to begin with, even if, you know, they always changed it and they freaked out every time they disagreed with it and blah, blah, blah. There's a reason you put an objective piece in there. And I think going back to some sort of formula would be a very, very advisable move. They're not going to. So the second half of my column is basically, here's what we could do for the committee. Number one, give it better data. Like, even in the NCAA tournament, they always make selections that are maddening, but they have access to actual, like, strength of record type data that is on their sheet that they see when they're comparing teams. They have, like, the quality indicators, the Ken Pomeroy type stuff. They have access to that. The CFP has always been proudly against it. We are not going to have that in this room. But they have data in their room. They have a bunch of data that repeats itself and data doesn't help the process at all.
Yeah, it's kind of an old school data approach.
Yeah, so that's always been the thing with me about people who complain about analytics. Like, they still use data. The whole point of analytics is hopefully to use better data. And so giving them better tools and just adding a little diversity of thought to the committee itself. Like, why do we need 13 people in that room? Seven of them are athletic directors, active athletic directors, who have to leave the room if you're talking about certain teams, and who have jobs that should probably distract them from watching loads and loads of football. I've never really understood that. But why is it that, like, active media members can't be a part of it? I'm not volunteering, by the way. I would be miserable on a committee. But why can't we put nerds like, you know, my old Football Outsiders mate Brian Fermo? Why can't he be on the committee? Like, why can't we diversify in that way? To at least have people like a more broad range of influences in the committee. At the very least, we should be going in that direction, even if a formula is forever going to be unrealistic.
Yeah, I would be tempted to just say, let's use Bill's formula. Let's just do SP Plus. But there is a component of, as again, even as you have said, that's not the last word, even for you. And you have seen SP Plus spit out some results that you go, okay, listen, the numbers are the numbers, so you don't necessarily disagree with the numbers, but even you have seen some results that go, yeah, looks like SP Plus is kind of digging that vibe more than I would personally.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And I think, you know, and that's the whole, like, best versus most deserving argument that we always have. Like, most deserving should probably carry more weight. I did fiddle in this piece that's coming up this week. I did fiddle with like three parts strength of record, the ESPN analytics number, and one part SP plus. What would that look like when you combine it with the polls? It looks mostly like what we get, because, you know, for like 6 of the 10 years of the playoff, the selections at the top are pretty easy, and it replicates most of those, but it quite obviously has Florida State in instead of Alabama last year, and it also has, on average, like the best G5 team is 3, 4, 5 spots higher than they always end up in the committee, because the committee's looking at a comparisons tool that has like 38 different little red dots telling them how much their schedule sucks. And you know, we need to streamline a little bit of that. That would probably help. But just in general, like we could get a formula that kind of comes up with the intent that we want, and it would produce pretty similar results, but it would add objectivity to the process, and things like the groupthink that happened with Alabama against Florida State last year wouldn't happen as easily.
Bill Conley, you can read his fine work at ESPN.com. SP Plus is one of the staples of the offseason. Definitely will get you into the mindset of, okay, what's my team going to be like next year? Bill, man, always appreciate you coming on. Glad I gave you a chance to rant a little bit. And, you know, hopefully maybe we get a chance to bump into each other in person at some point in this off or season coming up.
Sounds good. I look forward to it.
And now 3 and out, first down. I'll post my story from last week in the show notes that gives a more detailed breakdown of the CFP revenue distribution model, just in case you missed the reporting that has been bouncing around for about a week and a half. Bill did a good job of conveying frustrations. I wanted to circle back and hammer home one particular point. When this playoff expansion model was first unveiled, I was led to believe that the revenue distribution system was going to be a little more like the NCAA basketball tournament, where schools and conferences were rewarded for performance in the playoff. The unit model that we have all become familiar with, something like that. As Bill said, the guaranteed distribution I thought would be somewhat similar conference to conference, but where the SEC, or maybe even the Big Ten, would be able to separate itself was by getting more teams in and having those teams advance farther. That seemed to make sense. If the best conferences wanted more of the money, then emphasize the performance pool and de-emphasize the shared distribution pool. Clearly, that's not where this landed, with the Big Ten and the SEC guaranteeing themselves nearly 60% of the distribution. Meanwhile, the performance bonuses are all but going away. There's going to be a little set aside for independents that make a run. But for the most part, what you get is what you get guaranteed. And how your teams do and how many teams get in doesn't really have much bearing on how much money you get in the CFP in terms of conference distribution. It frustrates me that we have that kind of revenue distribution model, in the same way the talk of multiple AQs for the Big Ten and the SEC frustrated me. So you say you deserve more because you have the better teams. Well, then let the results determine that. And if you dominate the event in the way you believe you will, then the money will flow. And I understand it's hard to make budgets that way, right? You need guaranteed distribution so you can have a locked-in model of how much you're going to be working with. Right now, everyone in major college sports is looking to wring every last dime they can out of every system as they get ready to pay athletes and pay off potentially monumental settlements for a few lawsuits. It's all just so very disheartening. College football used to be better at least creating the illusion that the competition was more important than the business, was more important than the finances. Now, that's kind of out the window. Second down. In a really surprising move announced last week, Trev Alberts is leaving Nebraska to become the athletic director at Texas A&M. Alberts is a former Cornhuskers star defensive end from back in the program's glory days. He came in at the end of Scott Frost's failed tenure as football coach, got rid of Frost, and hired Matt Rhule. Albert seems to have done a pretty good job during a relatively short tenure, and not long ago got a big contract extension from Nebraska. He also had been looking into other gigs, non-AD gigs, like Big Ten commissioner and college football playoff executive director. Not sure if you want to call him a finalist, but he was definitely on the short list for the CFP gig. There is some transition at Nebraska above Albert's at the university. The school has yet to replace its president, who left for Ohio State. Not knowing who your boss is tends to cause angst among college administrators. There is also a civil lawsuit against the university pending from a former women's basketball player. Albert's was mentioned in that as the head of a department, but how much that might have influenced his decision is impossible to know. I want to step back from the nitty-gritty of this move for a second, though, and take a wide-lens view. Texas A&M just paid $85 million to fire Jimbo Fisher. It will spend another $4 million to buy out Albert's deal with Nebraska. That's couch cushion money for A&M, of course. But yet again, another example of how there really is no fiscal accountability in big-time college sports and the strangeness of the market in general. How do we determine how these people are worth so much money? What exactly is A&M getting in Albert's that is worth a $4 million buyout on top of what you're going to pay him? Was he such a desirable commodity? Was it name brand value to a certain degree? People know who Trev Alberts is because of his football career. If you're a Nebraska fan, I know this is disappointing to see one of your own leave at a time when it seems like arrows are pointed up, not just in football, but several other marquee programs. But what was so great about Trev Alberts as an AD? Continuity is important. I think mostly that's what you're paying for these days. If you get somebody who shows some competence, you've got to lock that competence up because you never know what's going to happen when you spin the wheel and have to start hiring another person and bringing in new leadership. But the idea that ADs are now worth $4 million per year of salary plus a $4 million buyout to get them is yet another example of why it's hard to take seriously administrators who cry about financial ruin if the athletes are paid. We here in the media are somewhat culpable. Much like with coaches, we've turned ADs into stars and artificially inflated their value, at least I think. Or Albert's 3-2-1. Alberts is a sharp guy. I'm sure he'll do a solid job at A&M. Again, he seemed to be doing a solid job at Nebraska. But to me, this looks like an example of what's become all too common in college sports. Job hopping to stay ahead of the posse, with your performance almost directly and exclusively tied to the success or failure of the football program. Nebraska loves Alberts now. But if Rule can't get things turned around in another year or two, Huskers fans will tire of Trev, too. Why'd you bring in this NFL guy and give him all that money that now we're going to have to buy out? He wasn't the solution. No matter how many championship teams he played on during his time in Lincoln, Albert's term as AD, you know, will be judged by his term as AD and how the football program did then, not how it did when he was playing under Tom Osborne. At A&M, Albert's won't be responsible for Mike Elko, who was recently hired by Ross Bjork, now the AD at Ohio State. So Albert's rests easy knowing that if Elko fails, that won't drag him down and he'll get to hire his replacement, right? The clock starts again, giving Albert's a nice long runway for about 5 or 6 years before now he's the one being judged for the football program. I don't begrudge anyone job hopping. There really is no loyalty left in college sports. Again, those fans that they say love you now will turn pretty fast, so trying to please them is not a great way to make important life decisions. It's just weird that we have gotten to a place where these administrators have become so highly valued. Third down. Okay, just a little bit of college basketball now because you got to pick a Final Four, right? I mean, you're just contractually obligated to as a sports writer. I haven't given this a ton of thought. And when I finally submit my my house bracket, because the only bracket pool I do is with my daughter and my wife, I may even change my mind on some of these picks. But first off, I do think it might be a chalky bracket this year after the mayhem that we had last year. I have thought a lot about how the universe might need a UConn upset this year to balance off the miracle run it made in the 2014 tournament from a number 7 seed to the championship. So who can upset UConn? Well, if you look at Auburn's metrics, they fall into a category that includes a lot of teams that are 1s, 2s, and 3 seeds, even though the Tigers are a 4 seed. So it seems like there's good value there. Even the odds makers have them a little higher in terms of their odds compared to their seed. Repeating is very hard. It has not been done in a while. So I'll take Auburn in the East. The West region with North Carolina as the 1 seed looks like it could get very messy. I almost annually get burned by Arizona. I don't really trust this Alabama team. I was toying with St. Mary's getting through as a 5 seed. I don't really love Baylor at the number 3 seed. So I guess that leaves Carolina. So I'll go Tar Heels, Auburn on that side of the bracket. The other side, I pretty much decided to ride or die with Kentucky and its 2 lottery picks and terrible defense about 3 weeks ago. I'll stick with the Wildcats coming out of the South. In the Midwest, I think Purdue is going to have a Virginia-like bounce back from being eliminated by a 16 seed last year. In a matchup of Kentucky and Purdue in the Final Four, I'll take Purdue. I'll take Auburn on the other side. And in keeping with the Virginia theme, I'll take Purdue, like the Cavaliers, to go from humiliation to exhilaration by winning its first national title. That's the show for today. I'd like to thank my producer, John Radcliffe, for making me sound good. You can find this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, just about anywhere you like to get your pods. Please follow so you do not miss an episode. I'm Ralph Russo, the college football writer with the Associated Press. Thanks for listening, and come back for more next week of the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast.